song.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. I'm really pleased that so many people have turned out on quite a cold night. I'm very pleased to welcome Mike Derbyshire, whom I think many of you will know or will have heard of. So he's quite a well-known local historian. And he has taken a lot of interest in flora and fauna, and we do consult him quite closely on any developments which may affect the historical remains on the site, and we're very grateful for that. This is the first of our history sessions, and one thing we're hoping is that people who are of a special interest in that area... people who have a special interest in that area may want to engage in some independent research. Or, we won't have time to discuss that this evening, but there may well be themes that you could pick up from Mike's talk. So if you are interested along those lines, please listen out for that. But I'm not going to talk anymore, so I'm going to hand over to Mike.
Thank you very much indeed. Yes, I've been described as a historian, and I think I just about accept that. I must make clear, though, I'm not an archaeologist, and there does seem to be a wee bit of confusion on this. Historians deal with dusty old documents, archaeologists with bumps in the ground. And I do get consulted about bumps in the ground, and I get out of my area of expertise very fast, I'm afraid. So, on the history side, I'll accept some responsibility. The other thing I must mention is that I am being recorded, and because of this I will be slightly more discreet on one or two points than I would have normally been. So anybody who's come mainly to hear my indiscretions, leave now and I'll not be offended. What I intend to cover this evening is firstly, of course, the history of the fields that the Fairfield Association and its relatives have acquired an interest in, both in a bit of detail and in the context of the rural aspects of Lancaster. I'm then going to comment a bit about how we know what we do know, because that will certainly be of interest to people who may be wanting to take some of this further. And I will hint at, mention one or two themes that people might be interested in pursuing. I assume that most people will be familiar with the areas that we're talking about, the fauna area, the orchard, the flora area, and to the north is some land which I understand is leased, I think. Is that right, Mike? Mick, from the Lancaster Girls Grammar School?
No, we lease fauna from the City Council. The Grammar School own their field themselves, but they have let us have school pond as part of the nature reserve, and they let, at the moment, they let Robin Loxham graze his cattle on that field because they're not using it for anything else. But they hope at some point, I think, to use it for something or other to do with recreation for the girls. They haven't decided what yet.
Okay. There's some very interesting remains on there, and they did have proposals to flatten it all for some sort of sports facility, but that seems to have fallen through. Okay, so we've got the brown land, which is under some rather complex arrangements, the blue fauna land, which is leased from the council, the orchard, and the newly acquired flora land, which has been bought outright. Do note on that map the black line. That is the boundary, the ancient boundary, ancient running from about the 12th to the 19th century, the boundary between Aldcliffe and Lancaster. So you have got one field in Aldcliffe. To concentrate on Lancaster, first of all. Lancaster is in no sense an historic city. We don't even know the Roman name for it. It wasn't even a legionary base. They only had auxiliaries here, the foreigners. It was never thought worth walling. It was never a great, certainly after the Norman Conquest, it was never a great ecclesiastical centre. And probably most significantly, it wasn't a city until the 20th century, until the 1930s.
You've just lost my job. Pretty much nothing plays, John.
There'll be a but. In fact, from the period I've mentioned, from the 12th to the 19th century, it was also rather tiny. About the same size as Bulk and Oldcliffe, almost as big as Ashton, and a good deal smaller than Scotford and Cornwall. But it has exceptional historical remains and a very interesting written history as well. To have the bumps and humps that Lancaster has alongside the castle, I'm thinking of those on Key Meadow or Vicarage Fields, whatever you want to call it, between the castle and the priory on the one hand and the river on the other, which haven't yet, of course, been explored in detail. It is an exceptionally interesting place to study. For most of its history, it was an agricultural, I think, large village, even rather than small town. And there is a map as late as the 1680s. And here we have, if it was better focused, even those at the back would be able to read it, arable, 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 coming right into the middle of the town. Right, well, to start the historical sequence, perhaps to go back to where we normally start these things, Norman invasion. The Normans started building the castle here. The church, which had been quite well established before that, was given to a monastery in Normandy, the monastery at Saves, and ceased to have a lot of status of its own. All its assets were given to Saves, and it became what was known as a priory, an outpost for the Norman monastery, the mother house in France. But the most significant thing from our point of view was that early on, probably in the 1090s, Lancaster was made a borough. The earliest charter is, of course, 1190 something or other, but that reads as though it's a confirmation charter. It doesn't read, because it's addressed to the burgesses, it's addressed to the citizens of the borough, which implies that they already existed. And it's quite likely that it was founded at the same time as the castle was started. The important point there is that made the village, or town, as it would become, self-governing to a large extent, and created this structure of burgesses' plots in their tofts and crofts, their little plots with the houses attached in the centre of the town, and linked to them, each citizen, each burgess would also have an allocation of strips in the arable fields. The fields would be a mixture of open fields with just strips owned, unfenced by different people, and in between them there would be privately owned fields, some of which might have been arable, others might have just been rough pasture. We know the location of quite a few of these fields, and I'll just draw attention to ones that we will hear more about later on. Edenbreck, which is, people may know Edenbreck House, is in the same location on Sunnyside Lane. Sourholme, that's next to Oldcliffe Lane, which is down here. And New Close, sometimes called Swallowholme, seemed to change its name, which is near the railway line just north of where it crosses Oldcliffe Lane. I must draw attention to the fact that these fields are all rather small, and that is typical of open, unfenced strips, how they were arranged in the northwest, and contrasts with the more well-known arrangement, which you find in the Midlands, which is what's often taught, that you had enormous open fields, perhaps only two or three for a big village. That was not the situation around here. It was much more typical to have this sort of arrangement of small open fields. The farms, the farm buildings, were almost universally in the town. They were not scattered around these fields in general. People would have their barns and farm buildings near the centre, perhaps on their patches where they were doing their trade as well, and they would come out from the town to their strokes when they were farming. Yes? Question?
Those narrow fields would be like?
All these things, of course, changed over time. Probably when the arrangement was set up, which was probably even before it became a borough, then it got adapted, there would probably be a fence round there, and then all these strips would just be marked with boundary, little boundary markers, and there would be no division. So everybody here would have to have a similar form of cropping. They'd have to let it go in fallow together, let it be grazed by animals together, and what have you. Possibly even, well, most of the time they're just growing oats, actually, not a lot else would grow up here. The bigger Moordale was several what were called furlongs, it was subdivided, and those were probably each fenced and could be managed separately from each other, but within each one everyone would have to do the same thing. The form of agriculture would be, as I say, probably growing oats on quite a scale, and the ploughing would be done with oxen. There's quite a few references to 8 oxen being required to pull the ploughs on the heavy clay that we had. And I think that's a good educational opportunity for the children. How would you turn round a plough if it's being drawn by 8 oxen? And the answer is, I think, as infrequently as possible. And hence the long strips, of course. No point in having a compact, small space if you get to the edge of it more often than you need. The this method of ploughing has left us quite a lot of remains. Traditional ridge and furrow, which you tend to get if you plough up and down the hillside, and terraces, very gentle terraces known as lynchets, if you plough along the contour. And that is a shot taken of the flora land from Sunnyside Lane, looking south there. And another one taken from a bit further up Sunnyside Lane, across onto the girls' grammar school land. Again, very marked terracing that has been formed by the ploughing along the contour. And to put it in scale with some of the local residents, yes?
Does the terracing come as a consequence of the ploughing, or is it deliberately constructed to make the ploughing easier?
Just check who's in the audience before I answer that. I suspect there's nobody who knows a tremendous amount more than I do about that. There's considerable difficulty on that, and the next example will expand on that. In general, I think quite often there are a mixture of attempts to make more of a level area by artificially encouraging, perhaps building up small walls to make some terracing, but also with the old ploughs only turning the sod one way, there was scope for manipulating how the soil built up. You didn't plough one way then reverse the ploughshare and come back again. You had it going different ways on the different times. And this clearly builds up a ridge if you're on comparatively flat ground. If you're on a terrace, they could manipulate it to reinforce the terracing, I think. So I think both there was a bit of a tendency for it to curve itself, especially when there was a natural boundary which didn't go across. You can see this on hillsides now. Even quite a small, insignificant hedge along the contour can lead to a build-up of soil above it, and a falling away below. just from it being worked.
Do the lynches that we see on the ground marry with the strips that you showed on the map?
Yes, yes. I'll move on to the next one, which I think makes this even clearer. Whoops. I've been asked specifically to comment on the Ripley Heights, I think it's called, the field across the canal from the flora land.